I'm a big believer that pills don't teach skills. Whether it's for mental health or physical health, there's a lot of things that we can change and influence in our day-to-day life, from exercise to what we eat to who we interact with, that we can't just fix with a pill. And so I would be talking to that person about where they want to go, where they want to be, what's getting in the way, perhaps understanding the history. And grief can be part of depression. It can be that feeling of helplessness and loss of enjoyment in things, and that can come from grief. When we try to selectively numb certain emotions, we actually numb the more pleasant emotions too. So yeah. It's like with your sense of smell, you can't just not smell dog poo, right? It's either you smell all the smells, you smell dog poo,
yeah.
You smell roses and cologne and scented candles, but you can't just selectively not smell certain smells. If you step on dog poo, you're going to smell dog poo. And emotions are a bit like that. If you're trying to numb sadness, you're actually going to numb joy. If you're trying to numb grief, you won't let yourself experience love. When we try to selectively numb certain emotions, we actually numb the more pleasant emotions too. So it's like with your sense of smell, you can't just not smell dog poo, right? It's either you smell all the smells, you smell dog poo,
yeah.
You smell roses and cologne and scented candles, but you can't just selectively not smell certain smells. If you step on dog poo, you're going to smell dog poo. And emotions are a bit like that. If you're trying to numb sadness, you're actually going to numb joy. If you're trying to numb grief, you won't let yourself experience love.
So welcome. We're here with Marie Bukakis. That's right? So she has been gracious enough to come on this podcast. This is the second part of an amazing, little swap that we had. And now we're talking about ADHD from the therapy perspective. So welcome.
Thanks for having me. I love doing little podcast swaps because you get to kind of cover things that you don't normally talk about on your normal podcast. So this has been a really fun process.
Yeah, I'm glad you enjoyed it too. Yeah. And I'm always curious about, because I know it from the coach's side, but I don't really know it from the therapy side. Like, I've kind of talked to my therapist and I have a pretty good relationship with that, but we really don't go deep into a lot of this. So this would be definitely an awesome little treat for me. So before we get started, how did you get involved with your podcast?
It started off, I actually have two podcasts. I have This Complex Life and one called Inside Social Work. So the Inside Social Work one started first. I was working in universities with students on placement. And so one of the things we have to do as part of our qualification is 2 500-hour, so 3-month unpaid placements. And we have different people from the university go out and see if the placement is supporting the learning objectives and provide supervision. And I just started interviewing some of the host organizations. There were some social workers doing really amazing things, from working in legal settings to starting their own charities, working in substance use. I mean, the breadth of exposure to different fields of social work really impressed me. And so I just started recording some of those conversations, and eventually that podcast grew and it's still going. It's in about, I think it's its 7th year now.
Wow.
And for a little while I paused it and created This Complex Life, because while I loved interviewing other professionals, I didn't offer services for other professionals. So I was doing therapy. I was running, group private practice. I had couples therapy, family therapy, and a few supervision session. So it's sort of like, I guess, what's the US call it? Like consultation hours, or there's another name for it. So I paused that for a little bit and started This Complex Life. So I was interviewing similar people, but I was asking them about the work that they do for a general audience rather than how they got to where they got to. So I was still interviewing mental health professionals, researchers, but instead of thinking about the audience being other mental health professionals, it was what would the general public, how would they like to hear that person talk? So it sort of started that way, by having hopefully longer, nuanced conversations rather than really small clickbaity things that didn't provide enough context or allow for exploration of a topic. And yeah, so now I've got both of them and they keep me very busy. It's a labor of love, that's for sure.
No, I can imagine, like, you've got this practice, you got two podcasts, like, that's an amazing amount of, you know, and from where you've come from, like, it's an incredible journey. Like, it can't be easy being in social work and starting out as, like you said, an intern. So what really drew you into, like, these fields?
My first job was actually, I worked a lot in the disability sector, and then I moved into, my first job was in aged care in a organization that supported people who'd been homeless or at risk of homelessness to access affordable housing and services. And I really loved that work. It was something that I felt I could do that intervened a little bit earlier rather than waiting for it to get to that point. So then I started working within a general adult population. And again, I was like, this is great. There's a lot of stuff we can do, but I still think I can go further upstream a little bit earlier. And then I settled on working with adolescents. And so that I loved that. I went and did some extra study, worked in schools. And then I thought, okay, cool. This is my spot. This is where I fit. But then they came with parents and they would bring a parent into the room. And I was like, I don't know what to do. Do I just, here's a brochure. Take this and read. Like, I didn't know how to navigate having more than one person in the room and it be therapeutic rather than just informative. And then I went and studied family therapy. So I'm sort of like the dual qualification that you would have there of LCSW and LMFT. It's both of those qualifications here. So now I do a lot of family work, couples work, and that's about as early intervention as I feel like I can get. So it's sort of, it all evolved bits and pieces. And then I sort of found the area that I really enjoy working with.
Yeah, that's an incredible journey. And I love how you, like, found your sweet spot. And even in that, you still were able to grow and face some of the fears. Like, it takes a lot of, you know, perseverance, you know, to really follow your heart, and bravery just to, like, step out into something like that you may or may not feel like is going to be as good as what might be with a little bit more education. Like, I definitely can relate to that, because, like, that's similar to what I'm trying to do, is, like, you know, push the envelope and do it, you know, and continue to grow and continue to get bigger and continue to help, you know, people in a better way. So many people with ADHD feel they've been misunderstood or misdiagnosed for years. What are some of the most common misconceptions you see in therapy?
I do have a lot of people at the moment, I mean, a lot, maybe a bit of an exaggeration, but who are recently being diagnosed with ADHD, and it's questioning previous diagnoses of things like bipolar or borderline personality disorder. So that can feel really, I think, a lot of grief. Grief is the largest feeling that comes up. Grief for what could have been, grief for what could have been different if I'd known earlier. Sort of like you mentioned in your story around that harsh dialogue that you have in your head, sometimes there's a bit of a grief for how I've treated myself. I thought I was stupid. I thought I wasn't enough. And all along it was, you know, maybe like someone who was playing, it was being naughty in class because they couldn't see the board. They physically needed their eyes checked and needed glasses. And it's a lot of those feelings. So the misconceptions are around laziness, not caring, not trying hard enough. But people, when they get that diagnosis, I think grief's the biggest feeling that they talk about in therapy.
Yeah. So what are some of the things that you do to help them get through that grief?
It depends on how they came to therapy. So some people come with the diagnosis and then they have a bit of an idea of what they want to do in therapy. And for others, through our sessions, I might start to see traits of ADHD and I recommend the assessment. And so we come at it from a different angle there. A lot of it is a lot of schema therapy. So understanding those different beliefs you have about yourself and the world. And we try and figure out what they are and maybe where they come from and how we can adapt the behavior to not be as perhaps keeping you stuck or a self-fulfilling prophecy. So we can look at some of those, a lot of self-compassion, and sometimes bringing in partners or parents or, you know, even housemates, bringing in other people to sort of talk about how they can be supportive, or maybe they can educate themselves and see ways that they can support that person. It's so varied. I do see a lot of comorbidities with anxiety and depression, and it makes sense, especially the symptoms that come with not feeling inadequate, never feeling good enough, feeling that rejection sensitivity. So a lot of that can lead to a really low mood or a lot of anxiety in social settings. And so we might tackle that in a targeted way as well.
Yeah, definitely can relate with, like, you know, I've had some conversations with my therapist about, like, you know, the importance of having the right diagnosis, because it could, you know, especially in kids, like PTSD could be easily mislabeled for ADHD, and those two treatments are completely different, and one could end up having a lot more damage to that patient, you know, or to that client that you have. And you know, it's great that you see that, and you know, not and unfortunately, like, not a lot of therapists do see that. They just want to make a quick diagnosis and get you out the door, you know, maybe even prescribe you medication. So like with grief and depression, they're very close, and you know, it's hard to differentiate the two. Do you have like a way that you can do that?
In what way? Like how I would adapt the treatment for ADHD, or how would I know which area to sort of focus on?
Yeah, which one they're really, like, are they just, you know, suffering from grief or a loss, or are they actually clinically depressed?
I mean, to me, it doesn't matter as much. I'm not as fixated on the labels. And here, the way our system works, we don't need to have that much clarity in the diagnosis to be able to access our Medicare system. And our health insurance here works a little bit differently. So the diagnosis to me is only as useful as it provides direction to what to do. And I'm a big believer that pills don't teach skills. Whether it's for mental health or physical health, there's a lot of things that we can change and influence in our day-to-day life, from exercise to what we eat to who we interact with, that we can't just fix with a pill. And so I would be talking to that person about where they want to go, where they want to be, what's getting in the way, perhaps understanding the history. And grief can be part of depression. It can be that feeling of helplessness and loss of enjoyment in things, and that can come from grief. But then I also don't want to be focusing on a diagnosis of depression when it is just, not just grief, that minimizes it.
Yeah.
When it's grief. Especially when it's actually like bereavement of the loss of somebody, it's very different. So understanding what's happened prior to someone coming to see me can shape that treatment a little bit. And then with some modalities like acceptance and commitment therapy or EMDR therapy, which are two that I like to use, the diagnosis doesn't really matter as much, because we're focusing on certain memories, mindfulness, adaptive processing. And we can intervene at a number of different points without having to know an exact diagnosis for some of those, which are often quite mixed presentations. It's not unusual that someone will have anxiety and depression, or will have a diagnosis of ADHD and have poor mental health as a result of not fitting in or not feeling that they can cope with day-to-day things, or that emotional reactivity or difficulty regulating emotion. So it can be really hard to sometimes separate those into neat diagnoses. It doesn't fit.
Yeah, I can imagine. And a lot of people, you know, do have those like co-concurring or dual diagnosis. You know, it's not like we just have one thing and that's it. You know, it's a lot of it is, I believe, you know, from, you know, a product of the environment that we grow up in and the system that we have. So kind of switching gears a little bit, you've trained schools and workplaces to have tough conversation around mental health. What's one common mistake organizations make when trying to support mental health, and what should they do instead?
Wow, big question. There's two bits. One is being so scared to say the wrong thing that they say nothing.
Yeah.
And then on the other side is when someone isn't doing so well, we try to fix it. So just like we were talking about in part one of this conversation where you were saying what you would do for your younger self is to show compassion and hold space and, you know, be attuned. That's the piece that's missing. So often people will jump in and try to fix it. I think positively, just, oh, but you're so lucky to just have dot, 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 or just be whatever. And they try to fix it. They try to take it away. They try to brush off the sadness or the pain or the whatever the emotion is. And that leaves people feeling disconnected, that they're not being seen, not being heard.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's more on an individual level, those conversations, but certain organizations or cultures create a culture where they handle that differently or they role model that differently and invest in training, and whether that's for managers or for leaders through their orientation or onboarding or when people get promoted, is actually teaching those skills that maybe we label as soft skills, and so they seem very maybe gendered or not important, but those communication skills, listening, holding space, showing empathy and validating are crucial for working, for working relationships, and in particular when someone's not okay or not even having a mental illness or mental ill health, just not feeling good or having something happen on their weekend. Like, we underestimate the power of listening and empathizing.
Yeah, definitely. And that's powerful, you know, and it's like what you said. I know growing up, I was like, if you said, yeah, just it's okay. And, you know, like you only got this, or just be, you know, just smile, just be positive, I'd be like, you know, pretty much like, go screw yourself. Like, you don't know what you're talking about. Like, it's not that easy. And you're not, and first off, you're not even telling me how to do that. Like, you're just telling me what to do and that I'm a problem, basically. And I need to just figure out on my own how to get better with that. And that's when all I really need is somebody to just be like, you know, like in my workspace the other day, like my manager asked me, he was like, how are you doing? And I was like, not really that good. And he was like, me too. Like, and it was just great because it was like, we're not trying to pretend to be good. We've developed this relationship where it's like, it's okay to admit like, yeah, I'm not feeling so fly right now. And in a sense, like that helped me and him get through that day better, because it's like, I don't have to carry this all by myself, or I don't have to pretend and put on a smile. So I know you probably do get some pushback on, like, you know, some of those things that you talk in trying to help schools. Like, what do you do? Do they come to you for the help, or is it something where, you know, somebody asks you to come in and there's some challenge in there? How does that work out?
It's all of those things. So some will have a leadership team that prioritize learning around about mental health or relationships or difficult conversations. And actually, I think we underestimate, a lot of people do value it.
Yeah.
And yet there are so many things that schools in particular are expected to do that make it hard to even find the money and the time, because teachers are already doing extra hours outside of school hours on weekends. So to get them to come in on a school holiday to do training is a big ask. To get funding to cover their classes with casual relief teachers on a school day is really hard, and it disrupts learning. And so it's quite logistically difficult to find time to do an in-depth training that offers a lot of value when people are fresh and awake and alert, because sometimes we can do a 1 hour talk at a staff meeting, but that's at the end of the day.
Yeah.
At 3:30, 4 o'clock, and everyone's already kind of pooped and they've had a full day of overstimulation with kids and teens and parents and bells and all the stuff that happened. And then they're learning about something that can be really difficult or really heavy. And so a lot of people do value it. It's finding the time to put it into a really busy calendar.
Yeah.
Some will have maybe an incident. They might see an increase in things like self-harm or suicidal ideation, or have a school counselor or well-being coordinator really emphasize the importance of this being a shared responsibility, not just one person's responsibility. And so those schools will come and ask to have some training, something like mental health first aid. That's a curriculum that's kind of like a structured curriculum that's through Mental Health First Aid Australia. Some will ask for just little shorter information sessions for their staff, and I run them around anxiety or school stress, exam pressure, demystifying and debunking myths around self-harm. So smaller, targeted, personalized training. And it really depends, like with the school, if I get an inquiry, we can have a bit of a conversation and co-create something that feels suitable. And if it's outside my skill set or someone else would be better suited, I can make some recommendations of where else to go.
That's awesome. That definitely helped, to really navigate that question in such an informative way. So it's more about finding the time and when they're ready for that information, because I know in my workspace, I'm part of this mental health committee, and some of it's like pulling teeth, some more of it's like, I don't know if they necessarily value mental health. It just feels like to me that it feels like it's more of a, it's not really taken as seriously as it needs to be. And, that can be disheartening, especially when you're part of a committee, and a committee is supposed to do, come up, it's supposed to do action, at least come up with something to help. And, when those things aren't, taken seriously, or just said, well, oh, okay, we'll look into that, but nothing happens, it can be frustrating.
Yeah, and as you were saying that, I mean, I don't have any official statistics on this, but in my whole working career, I've only met, well, that I know of, one person who's had to do CPR on somebody. And yet, the amount of people who've had to have conversations with a friend, a child, a housemate, a uni friend about suicidal thoughts would be, I would have lost count. And so, when people say, oh, we don't have these issues here, or mental health is whatever, I find it very interesting because we're faced with those conversations a lot more than we're faced with what we might learn in physical first aid. And also, those skills will not disadvantage you in other areas of your life. They enhance other conversations. Even me as a trained therapist who runs training, every single training, I learn something new. And so I think it's total crap if someone's like, well, I know all this already, because I might learn a new resource that I didn't know existed. Someone will phrase something in a way that I thought, wow, that's really cool. They might use an analogy or a metaphor that I'm like, I'm going to put that in my notebook for later. I'm going to take note of that. And so I learn something new every session, every workshop, every training. And so I don't know that I think we could all keep doing this, and it won't disadvantage us to learn more about mental health, communication, validating, empathizing, listening, what resources are out there, how to approach these conversations, because they're ongoing. We're in relationships all the time, and we all have mental health. And I think we could all benefit from learning a little bit more about how to have those conversations and look after our mental health and express concern and show support if we are worried about someone in a way that's going to be more conducive to a good conversation.
Yeah, you're definitely speaking my language there. Like it's about having those conversations, like literally. And I'm sure that these parents or these teachers are so much better equipped to handle the students once they've had this training and like implement some of those tools. And it's like, why wasn't this done? Because it's like the overwhelm, I believe, comes from the inability or the wrong mindset coming into these situations and viewing the kids as a problem, when it's actually like, if you understood that what was going on, they're not actually a problem. It's just maybe you need to just tweak how you're having that communication with them. Maybe you need to ask, like, the questions that you're asking need to change, you know, because I'd seen in this, that mental health committee, I actually had one the other day where it was like, I had the plant manager and the head HR and like, you know, a bunch of, you know, upper management in the meeting. And at first I was kind of intimidated because it was like, man, like, what do I do? You know, I'm not used to, like, this is the first time they've showed up and, you know, I've invited them and, you know, it was interesting. But I was like, you know, I went through it and, you know, I have like, you know, a partner that does it with me. So she did the slides and all this. And we talked about dealing with intense emotions at work. And there was a point where they all pretty much opened up about how they handle personal, emotional, you know, relationships with their partner. You know, it was a chance for me to say, like, you know, and almost all of them were talking about how they don't even know what their partner is dealing with. You know, so it was like an opportunity to be like, well, if you don't even know what your partner is dealing with, like, imagine how much more so, like, the people that you're working around. And one of, like, the guys was, like, actually talking about some deep, like, emotional baggage that he was carrying around, because I believe that was necessary for him to be there. So it was an incredible opportunity to kind of plant a seed to, like, hey, this is actually, like, really helpful, you know, just this session. And we're not even really trained to do that. Like, imagine if we got training in here. So I can definitely see that as something that it made a big difference in my day that day.
That's awesome.
So you help parents connect with their teens, which is not always easy. What's one thing parents often get wrong about what teens actually need from them?
It's that same thing of just trying to fix it. And I think parents, they want to take the pain away, or they don't want to see their kids suffer, or they want to problem solve it because they think, well, I've got the answer, I've got the solution. And most of the time, that's not what they need. They want to feel seen, heard, and understood. And that comes through empathizing with the feeling, validating it. And the validating bit is where parents get stuck. Actually, so many people get stuck because I think they tell me this, so I don't have to think it. They tell me that, but it means I'm agreeing with them. If I say, oh, it makes sense that you feel sad that your friend didn't invite you to their party, then I'm agreeing they should be sad, but they shouldn't be sad because their friend is being, you know, whatever. And I'm like, but that's not validating. He's saying, I see that for you, that hurt your feelings, and it makes sense that you're sad. It's not saying you agree that they should be sad, and they really struggle with this. And that's the bit that's missing is empathize. I see you're sad. Validate. It makes sense. You're really hoping to be at that party, or you really want to be included. It makes sense. I get that. I get why you're sad.
Yeah.
And then if needed, you might problem solve, or if they've done something that requires a conversation about, like, a consequence or a boundary, then you have that conversation. Then you might say, look, is there something you'd like to do together? Or what might you try? What could we do from here? Or what have you already tried? But if you go straight into, why don't you just call your other friend? Why don't we just go to the movies and forget about it? They might stop crying, but it's not because they feel better. It's because they've realized you can't handle when I'm sad.
Yeah.
So I'm going to hide it from you. And that over time creates so much disconnection and loneliness.
Yeah.
And I have young people sitting here thinking, I don't even think my parents like me. And their parents are, what do you mean? Of course I like you. I love you. Look, I'm trying to take all of this away from you and offer you this. Yeah. But we can't feel that way if people don't listen to us. If we don't actually feel heard and understood, we then don't feel like we belong. And that's the bit for me, is the empathizing, validating, what you said, holding the attunement, holding space. You mentioned in part one of this Gabor Mate, he's got some really good resources and books. He's got one, Hold On To Your Children, which I think is a really good one for parents. It's a bit clunky, it's quite long, but it's also an interesting book. But it's that communication piece is the bit that I think people could experiment with doing differently.
Yeah, no, there's a whole lot in there that's amazing. Especially like there's been this theme of even throughout the both of these podcasts is like of fixing, of this sense of fixing and like, and what I've seen from that is like if you say somebody needs to be fixed, it means automatically that we're broken. So it's like if you go into it without empathizing and like saying like, look, I know you're sad from that, and I get it, like. I'd be sad too. Like I totally understand that. And then going into like, what we can we try to help out with that? It's so small, but it's so powerful, you know. So like, thank you for sharing that. You know, I can imagine like how many lives would be different if we just saw each other as like fellow human beings that are just going through. Like, it's okay to feel sad, you know, especially for men. Like, I know in my experience, like sadness. When I did the work and continue to do the work on Saturday, it was one of the toughest emotions to process and allow myself to feel because it's as a man, it's like it's an invalid emotion. Like it should not it's come out of my mouth that I'm sad. So when I first said that to another man, it just felt weird. But it's like the more that I talked about it, the more I realized like there was something underneath that sadness that was like frustration and anger. That was buried underneath it and it continued to weigh me down, you know. And I was like trying to push it away and be positive and like, you can't feel sad. There's nothing to like, you're doing this. And it's like, but I am feeling sad. Like, I need to feel this. Like, where this may be coming from something long ago that I've been holding on to for years and it's coming up. And now I'm saying I'm here for myself, but I'm still pushing it down. You know, it's like, how can I expect the child in me to become confident that I'm trying to nurture and build that trust with if I continue to push down certain emotions. Like I can't just heal part of me without looking at everything.
And as you're saying about the pushing down emotions, you'll either try and numb it or overcompensate in other ways. So you might numb it with substances, or it might come out as anger or irritability. But the thing is, when we try to selectively numb certain emotions, we actually numb the more pleasant emotions too. So it's like with your sense of smell, you can't just not smell dog poo. Right? It's either you smell all the smells, you smell dog poo and you smell roses and cologne and scented candles, but you can't just selectively not smell certain smells. If you step on dog poo, you're going to smell dog poo. And emotions are a bit like that. If you're trying to numb sadness, you're actually going to numb joy. If you're trying to numb grief, you won't let yourself experience love. And so all of these things, they come together and they are one is a direct consequence of being able to feel the other. We can't love without ever knowing grief. We can't have pleasure without ever knowing pain. And so they all matter and they tell us something. They tell us what's important, maybe signposting what our values are, indicating what doesn't feel right. And it doesn't mean you have to dwell in it and let it take over you, but noticing it and acknowledging it is a really powerful thing that allows you to feel those other more pleasant feelings as well.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. And I'm always talking about how emotions are like my navigation for life, like my GPS. Like I can't navigate life if I'm not paying attention to what I'm feeling, you know, in an informed, mature way. It tells me where my boundaries are. It tells me what I should fear. And if I'm having an irrational fear for things, like everything, then I'm not going to be afraid of what I really need to be afraid of. And I'm not going to, you know, like not be afraid when I need to be brave. So it's important to like, you know, like you said, to feel all those and be able to feel those emotions more fully. I've got to be able to give myself the permission to feel every emotion. So one question that I'm curious about, how do you navigate the emotional toll of holding space for so many others while still caring for yourself?
As a therapist, it's taken a bit of practice. And I mean, I'm fortunate in a private practice setting, I control my own diary. So I've experimented with where I take breaks, how many people I see back to back. I have several regular supervision groups. So I have groups and individual supervision. So that debriefing, understanding cases, or even listening to someone else present a case helps me feel less alone or more connected. For me, movement is a really big one. So exercising before and sometimes after work, and not always with a level of intensity, but walking home, riding my bike home, coming home, walking the dog, I need that physical movement to decompress. And it's a lot of things that seem really boring, but I've really prioritized sleep, especially on days where I'm working. On the weekend, I can be a little bit cranky. It doesn't matter. The person I see first thing in the morning deserves to get as refreshed a version of me as the last one for the day. So I set boundaries with how many people I see in a day, how I schedule my calendar. I don't drink alcohol usually before. I don't drink much anyway. I eat well during the day, so I'm not sitting there in a session starving. And so it's all of those small, very boring things. Sometimes I'll go for a walk in between sessions, and that keeps me doing the work for longer. I'm more at risk of burnout because I love what I do. I can do it, like especially the content creation side, I can do it when I get home and on weekends. And that's, if I do that too often, that can be where I get a little bit burnt out, because even though I really enjoy it and I could be podcasting or editing videos or researching different people to interview, reading a nonfiction book before bed, I love it and I enjoy it, but my brain doesn't rest. And so that's actually my biggest risk factor, is because I love what I do, I could do it too often. And so to overcompensate for that, I go camping, I go hiking, I try and do things that take away the technology. That I was away this weekend and I didn't have phone reception for a good part of that time. And it forces me to enjoy nature and enjoy quality time with my friends, with my partner. We played board games instead of watching TV. And that just takes a bit of targeted prioritizing. Otherwise, I could fall into some really bad habits and then I'm not good to anybody.
No, that's awesome. I definitely can relate to all that. Like, I definitely have trouble with, you know, boundaries, because I love what I'm doing. And, you know, I want to do so many things, and having ADHD, it's just like ideas just pop off. It's, you know, a new thing enters and I'm all about it. So it's like, I've got to use my prudence to be like, yeah, look, that's not a priority right now. That's something that you can do later. And I have mental health days where I'm just like, okay, I'm not thinking about work today, you know, unless it's an absolute emergency. And like, I need to get better at like scheduling things where I'm like, you can't get a hold of me on certain days, because like, I know that that will help me on the days that I need to show up. I need that day to charge up for all the other days. So that's beautiful how you put that, you know, and that you see that in yourself as like an example. So before we wrap up, I have a bonus rapid fire session for you. You think you're ready?
Yes, fine.
So tea, hiking, or Uno, which one is your ultimate reset button?
I drink about 10 cups of tea a day, so that's pretty easy. But hiking is, I've just planned a 8-day hike with some girlfriends for next year. So hiking is the ultimate, but tea is much easier to fit in.
Yeah. What kind of tea?
I drink black tea in the morning and then I switch to peppermint green tea, and then like sleepy time or de-stressing kind just of like blends, or chamomile in the evening.
Oh, robust. So there's like a lot of hiking in Australia, a lot of good spots.
Yeah, so the next big one I'll do is in Tasmania, and this weekend I'll do some local ones, going camping for the weekend.
Tasmania, wow. I'm jealous. So what's one myth about therapy you wish would disappear forever?
That it doesn't help, or it's just talking. Just talking. Air quotes.
Yeah. No, it can be that if you believe that that's what's going to happen. But yeah, it's so much more than that. So what's one word you'd use to describe the teenage mind?
Growing.
Growing? That's awesome. I would say chaotic. But
think it,
you're much more
it's
kind
like,
than I am.
well, you used the example of an octopus being out of water in your last, in our other episode, but it's sort of like, imagine you've got each of those tentacles are growing. You're going to be clumsy. You're trying to coordinate them all. You're trying to figure out how to move in a different way. And it feels like that. The brain is growing, it's evolving, social identity, relationships, who you are, how do you stay connected, how do you be different. It's all growing. It's all of those eight tentacles growing at once. It's all these parts of us growing.
Yeah.
It's going to be awkward. It's going to be clumsy. We're going to trip and fall. We might be slippery. You put it in the wrong environment, it might not cope. And so, yeah, I think just growing and changing, and people forget that.
We're one of the only, creatures that really it takes us a few years to develop fully. And, and unlike a deer, they pretty much are ready to go from birth. Like we need a lot of care. So thank you for that insight. So if people want to, reach out to you and connect, how would they go about doing that?
So you can listen to my podcast, This Complex Life, or find me on Instagram and LinkedIn under Marie Vacarkas.
Awesome. Well, it's been a pleasure and an honor to do this seat swap with you. And it's definitely, seeing it from the therapist side has been very insightful. Thank you for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
All right, bye.
Thank you for listening. To keep the conversation going, head on over to Instagram or LinkedIn and follow me. If you'd like to keep updated with episodes and other interesting things happening in mental health, join my weekly This Complex Life newsletter, where I'll share tools, tips, and insight. There's a link in the show notes. Got a question you want answered? Shoot me an email or a DM. I'd love to hear from you. And if you enjoy the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could leave a rating and a review. It helps other people find the podcast.